Let me talk about 8 criticisms of the design argument, mostly given by David Hume. And I didn't put my own advertisement in the outline, but I've recently co-edited a book with James Sinnott called In Defense of Natural Theology, which will be published by InterVarsity Press probably about a year from now. And that book is a response to many of Hume's criticisms of natural theology. The chapter that I put on the webpage called Metaphysical Implications of Cosmological Arguments will be in that book along with about 10 other chapters. Hume is famous for saying, look, even if your argument works, and he usually was dealing with design arguments in his book, Dialogues on Natural Religion, even if it works, the deity that you derive from these arguments falls far short metaphysically of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of Jesus Christ. Now, he had some arguments against how effective the natural theology was in and of itself, but he says, look, I'll grant that it works. The God that you derive is still very, very far inferior, much inferior to the God of the Bible. I think that argument is essentially wrong. Let me give you some of the criticisms that he gave, and I want to give enough time for the argument from mine, because this is a fascinating and powerful argument. And we're getting hit hard on this issue in our culture, that mind is nothing but the brain. And a lot of Christians are going along with this, and it's very bad news. All right. People will say, look, you can't use this kind of an argument for design because the universe is a unique thing. How can you say the whole universe is designed? Because that's in a category by itself, assuming the many universe theory is not true, and you couldn't know what those other universes were anyway. So how can you say the whole universe is design? It's a unique case. We can't compare it to anything else. Now, that argument fails because people that study the Big Bang are talking about an absolute origination of the entire universe. Now, there may be nothing you can compare that to, but they still study it. They can still trace effects back to a cause. And I told you there are 4 or 5 lines of argument to indicate an absolute origination of the universe. People talk about and theorize about the first life on Earth. Well, that's a singularity. That had no analogy. People study, theorize, debate that question. You can debate and study and give arguments for singularities that have no clear analogy. Now, another argument that Hume gives is that, well, who designed the designer? Even if you get this in Dawkins, in The Blind Watchmaker and other things. Well, the explanation does no good whatsoever, because you have to explain the design in the designer himself. Well, wait a minute. There are various ways of dealing with this. One is, if you are positing God, the monotheistic view of God, then God is a self-existent being, a necessary being. Remember that from the cosmological argument. These arguments dovetail now. We're talking about the design features of the universe that indicate a designer. Now, we've already showed that the universe is not self-supporting. It could not have always existed. It came into existence. And the best explanation for that is it was caused by God to exist. And that being is a self-existent, necessary being. So a being of that sort doesn't have to be explained outside of himself, because that kind of a being is not contingent. That being has perfect knowledge, perfect power, perfect will, and all the rest. When we're explaining the universe, we're talking about contingent states of affairs, things that could have been otherwise, things that are not self-supporting, things that are not necessary, outside of, you know, propositions that are necessary truths. But if you're trying to explain the fine-tunedness, if you will, of life, and if you're trying to give an explanation for rationality and perception that makes it quite often reliable and so on, you're talking about a biblical view of God as the ultimate creator and the ultimate designer. And you're talking about contingent things being explained by something that's not contingent. So there is a finite regress of explanation here. It goes back to the original designer, who is not material, who is not contingent, in principle. And why posit that kind of a being? I mean, let's say you posit a finite contingent designer. That's not the God of the Bible. Now, that kind of a being would have to be explained, certainly. But it wouldn't be the God of the Bible or the God of monotheism, any monotheistic tradition. You with me on that? All right, why not many deities instead of one? Well, simplicity of explanation. If one explains everything, why posit more than one? We already really dealt with this in the cosmological argument. If you have more than one distinct separate beings, you have contingent beings anyway, and they would have to be explained, and we wouldn't get very far. But the theistic hypothesis is simpler and more powerful. It's not simplistic, but I think there's much more explanatory power in positing one than positing a variety of finite beings. Why not a material or corporeal being instead of an immaterial one? Well, the question would be, what sense would it make to think of a being who is the ultimate designer and creator who is material? Because if you have a material being, you have a being who would be contingent, whose features of being, whose qualities would have to be explained in and of itself. So why assume or why say that there is a physical being? Okay. Let me just look for something here quickly. The explanation that's given is an explanation according to a mind. Now, this factors into the argument from and for mind as well. We're trying to account for a plan in a mind that explains the purpose of things, explains the order, the beauty, and so on of the universe. So the explanation itself, we're not looking for a physical thing. If you are explaining, let's say, the paintings of Leonardo da Vinci, you're trying to think of his thoughts, his ideas, what influenced him. I don't think you'd be worrying too much about how much he weighed or his complexion or something like that. You'd be thinking more about his mental states that related to his creativity. Now, this comes back to, is the mind distinct from the body? But it's very difficult to imagine an eternal corporeal being given things like entropy and contingency. All right, another criticism is, well, you're saying the universe is like a machine, and machines need explanations. And why couldn't the universe be more like, this is one of Hume's tropes, a big vegetable, which is not formed by independent parts, it's an organic whole. Well, what we're looking for is a sufficient explanation for these contingent states of design. That's all. It doesn't have to be that much like a machine. We're talking about evidences for design. And you find some of the most powerful evidence for design in living things, like the bacterial flagellum. Now, interestingly, when you look at the bacterial flagellum, it is a molecular, it's called a molecular machine. And it has all these parts that must be there for the function to obtain. It's what Michael Behe calls irreducible complexity. You take away any of the features, like you would take away one part of a mousetrap and the mousetrap doesn't work, the bacterial flagellum doesn't work. The film we'll see later goes into great detail about this. Now, that's part of an organism, but it still shows a variety of parts very finely put together to achieve a particular end. So the universe can have machine-like parts and non-machine-like parts. The issue is, how do you explain contingent entities that appear to be designed? Okay. Another one is, evolution refutes the design argument. Two ways of dealing with this. One is to say, we'll grant you evolution. You still have to explain all the cosmic constants. Because all the cosmic constants, all the anthropic coincidences have to be in place for evolution to even have a shot at explaining the origin of life and the origin of species. Now, I'm not a Darwinist. I think that all those background conditions, anthropic coincidences, are necessary conditions for life, but not sufficient. I think God had to inject design to create species. The universe by itself was not sufficient. That is, God didn't hardwire the universe to produce life 15 billion years later or 14 billion years later. Some Christian theists believe that, such as Richard Swinburne. I don't believe it for two reasons. One, the Bible, and two, the complexity of life and the nature of information. So, you could grant Darwinism and say, look, you Darwinist, you still have to explain the extant universe when the first life appears, because all these things are necessary conditions. How do you explain those things? The other argument is to say, obviously, that Darwinism is not an explanation for how life developed, that it's evidentially insufficient. And we'll make that case later. Okay? Now, probably the biggest problem for the argument from design is the problem of evil, or the issue of what is sometimes called suboptimal design. This troubled Darwin terribly. He saw parasitism in nature and tremendous waste when it comes to pollen and cruelty, or maybe that's anthropomorphizing. Maybe that's the pathetic fallacy. But the activity of the animal world, as one poet put it, nature red in tooth and claw. And so he wanted to get God off the hook and say that God had nothing directly to do with the origin of life or the development of species. Well, the first book was dealing with the development of species. He didn't say much about the origin of life. He didn't have a clue. And in fact, Darwinists still have no clue. But how do you deal with what seems to be suboptimal design? Stephen Jay Gould played this card very often. The panda's thumb could have been designed so much more efficiently and effectively. God would have done that, therefore there's no God. You know, you see this argument all the time. You get it with the eye. Have you ever heard the eye version? We have blind spots. If God had designed the eye, there'd be no blind spot, therefore there's no design. In fact, I think the octopus eye is better than the human eye with respect to blind spots and certain problems. Well, obviously no design and no God. Let's think about that for a minute. There are two basic hypotheses. The matter first, last and always view, materialism of some kind. No design, no purpose. And there's the minded view that the universe owes its existence to a designer and a creator. Now, if you find reliable evidence of design, the inference naturally is a designer. Whatever the design may be is secondary. Now, I used to own a 76 Gremlin. Yeah, sorry. It was a great car. It was better than our stupid Intrepid that went dead after the warranty ran out. Anyway, I had a Gremlin for 20 years. And I deserve a medal for that. But the Gremlin had certain intrinsic and developed defects. It lived up to its name for many people. Now, I would never say, look at the defects in the Gremlin. It must have developed without any intelligence or design to it at all. Because look at the defects in the thing. You might say, well, that's a disanalogy because we know that humans make automobiles. But I think that's really beside the point because there are reliable indicators of design. That is, remember the two hypotheses, no mind and mind. Now, if we find the order, the complexity, the specified complexity, the beauty, and so on, we have some evidence of an intelligence that transcends the natural processes. Now, in terms of the defects or in terms of suboptimal or apparently suboptimal behavior, there is another Christian doctrine that is very important. It's called the fall. Now, we are not told specifically what the fall did to the natural world, except that animals will be afraid of us and life will be much more difficult for everyone. But if you're talking about Christian theism as an explanation for the universe, we attempt to explain the design according to a designer and we explain the pain and the dysfunction and the cruelty on the basis of the fall. But you see, the pain and dysfunction and the cruelty presupposes a design. Because good is first. Evil is good gone wrong. The only way you can identify a suboptimal system or function is to consider what it would be for it to be optimal. And the only way you can understand cruelty is to compare it with goodness. They're not symmetrical, axiologically or metaphysically. And moreover, there's a lot to this. We'll come back to it, I think, when we talk about creation evolution. It can be pretty arrogant to think that you have a suboptimal design because you have very limited knowledge. Why couldn't there be some reason why God gave us blind spots? Or he allowed a blind spot to come as a result of the fall, or he hardwired it in, whatever it is. How do you know there's absolutely no reason for that? Maybe it helps indicate our lack of knowledge, our limitations. I mean, it provides a really handy figure of speech, blind spot. I mean, how do you know that because there's a blind spot, there is no design whatsoever? And it's all the result of mindless natural forces. That's a non sequitur. You might say, this is an amazingly developed organism, the human being. The system itself, the eye, the anatomy, and then all the subsystems, the blood clotting cascade, and all the rest of it. But why does it have these defects? Why does it grow old and die? See? Then you get into the question of the fall. Paul, did you have a comment? Mm-hmm. Right. I love that one. I love that one. Yeah, the Darwinists were saying for years that something like, 90% of the DNA is junk. And that's what they would predict because there's no intelligence, there's no design. Genetic code just happened over time. And so a lot of it has no functionality. It's just leftovers. They're DNA leftovers from previous stages of evolution. So you would predict something like junk DNA if Darwinism were true. And so they could not identify the functionality of a lot of DNA, so it's junk DNA, so it confirms evolutionary theory. Guess what? It's almost all now identified to have a function. Now, what theory does that better fit? I love these kind of things. And they're happening all over the place. Junk DNA. That's now a junk science theory. But it was trotted out so often. You creationists, you superstitious pre-scientific people that are trying to retard the progress of human culture and throw us back to the medieval times, don't you see that life itself is full of junk? And so obviously it can't be from a creator. Oops. All right. Well, questions or comments? I want to get into the argument from mine. We won't have time to do it justice, but this is a very powerful kind of argument. Why? It has intuitive appeal. Bill Dembski is very optimistic. He's one of the leaders. He's probably the leading theoretician of the intelligent design movement. He's very optimistic. Intelligent design will win out over Darwinism eventually. Because there's an intuitive feel. But you see, he's taken, and others have taken the intuition and made it very thorough and very systematic in its argumentation. There's also a lot of different types of data to appeal to. The universe at large, small parts of the universe, segments of the universe, beauty, order, simplicity, rationality. There's a lot you can draw from. And you've got new facts delivered from the empirical realm, all these cosmic constants, all these anthropic coincidences that you can draw from. And I get the sense sometimes the naturalists are kind of like this. Many universes. You know? Why would you say it unless you were up against the wall? It's like, if you weren't here, you wouldn't see it. You know, I'm ridiculing it, right? But I'm ridiculing it not to substitute for an argument, but having given the argument to show it is so ridiculous. And I think you really have to come back to Romans 1. Having known God, they neither glorified God nor gave him thanks, but suppressed the truth within them. I think that's what a lot of people are doing. They're pressed against the wall. Many of them still suppress the truth and come up with some very amazing theories. I mean, I love this quote from Chesterton. You've probably heard it from his book Orthodoxy, published in 1908. He said, when people stop believing in God, it's not that they don't believe in anything. They believe in everything. Or they will believe in anything. It's not that they believe in nothing. They will believe in anything. I think we're seeing some evidence of that now. 100 years after he wrote that. All right. Questions, comments about this so far, design arguments? Yes. Sure. It still points to a design. You have to say, look, no design is a better explanation than either a flawed design or a perfectly good design that was corrupted at a later point. And it requires a kind of hubris to say, we know that it has no purpose. Like, we know all this in the DNA is junk. It actually comes out, it's not junk. And a lot of the Christian literature on this is trying to explore things that naturalists have said have no purpose and are just evolutionary leftovers and say, well, maybe there is something to that. I mean, there's the whole, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but it's just so good. You remember the old vestigial organ argument? You know, 100 years ago, they said there are dozens of vestigial organs. What's a vestigial organ? It's an organ that's left over from your evolutionary past. It has no function, but it's still there. And your appendix, the tailbone, I mean, tail. See, it was originally part of a tail. Now what happens? Just about all of them have well-known functions that are important to the human body. Oops. All right, let me talk about the argument for God from the existence of mind. This is a type of design argument. The ultimate claim will be that God is a better explanation for the existence of the human mind as an immaterial substance than either the material universe, materialism, or some kind of pantheism. Now, J.P. doesn't get into the pantheism too much. He does deal with the panpsychism, which is a kind of a type of pantheism, that everything is intrinsically conscious. But the main target is materialism. But I'll come back to pantheism if I have time. Now, first of all, let's just kind of sketch out what the claim is. The claim on materialist, physicalist grounds is that the mind is reducible to the brain. And I won't appeal to it, but the article by Pinker there, Steven Pinker, who's a great propagandist for naturalism, says basically, look, science now tells us, science proves that there is no mind. Why? Because mental states can be correlated with physical states. Well, that's just bad philosophy. Constant conjunction or constant correlation is not identity. That's just so basic. This is why philosophy is so helpful to develop a good BS detector. Bullshit detector. Because so many people play the hand of science says. Science has proven, right? We all know now that we have to leave behind the mind just the way we left behind the universe construed before Copernicus. Well, it could be that the scientists have made some major philosophical errors. And that's the case with Pinker. But this idea that the mind is reducible to the brain is very common in our culture. Did you have a comment over there?
Well, I just thought it was hilarious that he questioned
in the last
paragraph. How so? Initially that it's all been down to the brain, and yet Prozac shouldn't be dispensed like mints, of course. But the reason is not that it undermines the will, but that emotional pain, physical pain are not always pathological. So if it's not pathological, then how can you say it all is reduced to the brain?
Well, you know, he says you shouldn't be coerced in that article, that drugs should be taken freely to benefit the brain, but not through coercion. Well, I mean, if it's merely a matrix of material causes, then it's hard to find the human will or the human knower at all. you're merely the result of physical natural processes. There's only the brain. It's not that the mind uses the brain. It's that the mind is reducible to the brain. So developing any concept of responsibility or morality is extremely difficult on his worldview. In fact, he was the guy several years ago who wrote an article in the New York Times magazine about this woman who killed her baby. She was pregnant. She gave birth in the restroom and then finished the prom that night. Excuse me. And this was, of course, a terrible crime. And Pinker, who is known as an evolutionary psychologist, said, well, it's not that strange because you have to remember that many mothers, animal mothers, when they give birth, kind of make an assessment of how likely it is the child will survive. And some mothers in the animal world will kill newborns. And that's our background. So, you know, he says, well, I can't say it's good. And I can't condone it. But to anathematize this person and to call it deeply evil or to consider it murder is not right, given our evolutionary past. Now, I want to say, how can you condemn it at all, given a merely materialistic, closed system, causal closure kind of worldview? How can you find the idea of moral responsibility or weighing options morally and intellectually? Because you would be driven by your chemistry and your biology and the physics of the universe. There's really no you left. Because you see, this whole project of physicalism is to reduce first-person states to third-person states. And physicalists are very disturbed by consciousness. It really ticks them off. Because consciousness is not publicly observable. And consciousness is not quantifiable. You see, you can say how much I weigh, how tall I am, and other physical features, but in terms of getting into my mind and experiencing the world the way I do, you can't go from the third person to the first person. Physical descriptions won't cut it. They're not adequate. And this is a very difficult problem for physicalists. In fact, one writer, Colin McGuinn, or McGinn, wrote a book called The Mysterious Flame. He's a materialist. And he says that human consciousness will forever be a mystery. We will never explain it. Somehow evolution has hid the explanation from us. So it will always be an opaque, mysterious thing. And he's justifying that on naturalistic grounds. And he rejects substance dualism as a better explanation. But it's an amazing thing for a materialist who has this idea of the march of science from the pre-scientific, the ignorant, the superstitious, the world of spirits, the world of forces, dark, mysterious, frightening, to the world of physical events, natural laws, scientific explanations. And then we get into the human mind and understand it. It's neurobiology. But then, blast it, consciousness. Bugs me. We just can't quite get a third-person physical, material explanation for the darn thing. So McGuinn says, well, we never will. And so what? I'm still a materialist, damn it. I'm just speaking as he would speak, right? That's pretty weak. That's really weak. I mean, unless the dualistic explanation is more mysterious or completely unintelligible, and it's not. It's actually quite a good explanation. All right. And when I was citing what McGuinn would say, I was mentioning what he would say. I was not using the word myself, so don't commit the use mentioned fallacy. All right. Let's get into this here. Let's first of all talk about the challenge of physicalism, naturalism, materialism. There's some differences in how you use those terms, but the idea that the human mind is reducible to matter, reducible to the brain. First of all, what is matter? It's a pretty important question. Well, Material states are publicly accessible, or potentially so. You want to know what this desk is made out of? You can photograph it, you can weigh it, you can put it under a microscope, you can test it in various kinds of ways. Okay? Even a very far-off planet or star, it's at least potentially publicly accessible through a space probe, through a telescope, something like that, right? It's either spatially located or extended. It's in one place, or maybe you're talking about a field of force that's in many places. There is no teleology. There is no intrinsic purpose to anything material along these lines. I mean, the material part of it. No final cause. I'm talking about matter now. This last part is matter according to a materialistic worldview. But I think we'd agree that matter is publicly accessible and it is either spatially located or extended. We would argue that even matter has function and purpose that God built into it. But the materialist would not. So, what is mind? It may or may not be publicly accessible. At least, it is not directly publicly accessible. You cannot see thoughts, but you may see indicators or signs of thoughts. It's not spatially located or physically extended. It cannot be measured with a ruler, for instance. Mind. And it has purpose, teleological. Now, here's how the argument would work, and I can only summarize it. Can't do justice to it. But the argument is first that human beings, we'll just limit it to human beings for the time being, possess minds that are immaterial substances, that are not reducible to matter, that are not explicable according to physicalism, materialism. If that is the case, what then becomes the best explanation for the existence of mind in an otherwise material universe? We'll just bracket the question of whether certain animals might have minds or souls. What would be the best explanation? You see, so it's a two-step argument. First of all, you have to argue for some type of substance dualism. Once having argued for that successfully, you give a larger worldview explanation that theism would make more sense with respect to explaining the existence of finite, immaterial minds than naturalism or pantheism. Okay, do you see how that argument works, the structure of it? All right, we need to define a couple of terms here. I'll give you the short version of the argument. First of all, what is a property? JP talks about this. A property is not a particular thing. It can be in more than one place at once, like redness. It is immutable. So a leaf can change from green to red, but greenness does not change into redness. Properties can be possessed by something else. An apple is red. Properties do not have causal powers. They're not agents. They're not efficient causes. A substance is a particular thing, like a particular dog, particular horse, particular person. Substance can change and have opposites. A leaf can turn from green to red and be the same leaf. A tree can shed its leaves. Substances are fundamental existence. They are not in other things. Another term for this is that they are continuance. Continuance. They persist through changes. And a substance can have causal powers. Now, a materialist wants to claim that we have exactly one substance, material. That's it. And what is material should be publicly accessible and is not teleological and is in a place or extended, could be measured some way. Now, there are a lot of variations on ways of trying to have consciousness and be a materialist, but I think they all suffer from some basic problems. Now, there's some people that hold what's called property dualism. Substance dualism says that human beings are a combination of material and immaterial substances. Excuse me, it's not that one person has material properties and immaterial properties, but we actually have a material substance with properties and an immaterial substance with properties. But they interrelate. This is not some kind of Platonic dualism where or Gnostic dualism, you know, where spirit is good and matter is evil. Because we believe God created minds. God created minds in physical bodies. Now, one view of this, there's another view that's dualistic, which is called property dualism. And that is that we are a physical substance, but one of our properties is immaterial. So we're not a material substance and a immaterial substance together interacting. We're a material substance that has some immaterial properties, like thoughts. But the problem, one of the problems with property dualism is that because it doesn't have a substantival view of the self, it does not allow for mental causation. Now, I think we usually assume that our mind causes us to do certain things. That whatever the causal nexus and background is, if I decide to lift up this Bible, that a mental event caused a physical event. Now, if property dualism is correct, that can't happen. Because if my mental states are merely properties of a material substance, then they have no causal power. The example you can give is a shadow. A shadow would not exist apart from light and an opaque object, right? You take away the light or the opaque object, there's no shadow. But does the shadow have any causal power? No, it's completely passive. It's completely dependent and derivative. Or you might say it's like smoke and fire. To have smoke, you need to have some combustion. But the smoke does not cause the combustion. So some people bite the bullet and say we do have something immaterial about us, but it's only a property. Well, there are a lot of problems with that. The mental causation problem. The unity of the self problem. That how can you have a self that persists over time if it's merely just a product of changing material states over many, many years? That doesn't seem ontologically deep or rich enough to support a strong sense of personal identity. And moreover, on this view, look, when you're dead, you're dead. Because here's the shadow, but when you take away the hand of the light, there's no more shadow. Another term for this is epiphenomenalism. It's a second-class state of existence. So if this is true, when your body dies, there's no consciousness, period. Substance dualism is the claim that the mind is a distinct substance from the body. The mind interacts with the body and vice versa. And that the mind can exist apart from the body. All right, now how would we go to argue this view? Let me just begin the argument. We've only got like 5 minutes left, so I can't get into it sufficiently. First basic point, and I want to come back to it next week. We can get further behind. But the first basic point is, why under heaven even try to engage in this type of description? Why? Now remember that physicalism attempts to explain everything on the basis of merely material components. And it says you are nothing but a collection of material states. Now, the first question is, why even attempt that kind of an explanation, given consciousness, given self-awareness, given subjectivity? Well, for the vast history of the human race, not many people even attempted it because it was so wildly implausible. Sure, you have materialists going way back to the pre-Socratics, Democritus, and so on. And you have materialists even in the history of Western philosophy, Hobbes, and so on. But most philosophers, up until probably a century ago, I think this is right, were believed in the reality of immaterial substances. I think what drives physicalism is this notion of the march of science. Science is explaining in material terms more and more things that used to be attributed to spirits and purposes and objective meanings. It's like science is on a crusade to desacralize or demystify the universe, right? Now look, If our arguments thus far have been even halfway persuasive, that meaning the universe has a cause, it's not infinite in its life, the cause is a supernatural, personal being, that apart from the human mind, well, actually, we use the rationality argument, but looking at the universe in various dimensions, it indicates a designer, and that designer would be an immaterial designer. The creator would be an immaterial creator, because otherwise you'd have to explain the existence of that material creator, and it wouldn't explain anything. If those arguments are successful, then it seems to me that the impetus for giving a physicalist explanation of consciousness is taken away. Because if there is an immaterial creator, that creator certainly would have the wherewithal to create finite beings who are, have a material substance and an immaterial substance. You could explain the immaterial substance on the basis of God himself. God creates a finite replica of himself, so to speak, immaterially. But then God brings into being something completely new, which are material states of affairs. He does that at the beginning of the universe. Are you with me so far? You always got to look at background beliefs. Now, in our culture, there's this assumption of this long, steady, faultless march of science to demystify the universe. It's a crock. I mean, some of the best scientific evidence now supports Christian theism. So that's just a crock. The next question has to be, does physicalism give a compelling philosophical account of human consciousness? Let me give you the basic the basic problem. I want to come back to this next time. The basic problem has to do with the law of identity. Now, we've already got all kinds of reasons to question physicalism. The existence of numbers that refer to external reality, sets, values that are not merely subjective, propositions that are not identical to sentences, laws of logic, universals, JP mentions quite a few of those. You have, I think, some pretty compelling accounts of people actually leaving their bodies and giving reports of things that they could not have perceived in their physical body. I argue for that in one of my books, and there are other cases of that. But this is a thing you want to think about. Go back to that argument. Well, whenever someone has a thought or an emotion or something, we can correlate some activity in the brain. Fine. It doesn't hinder my faith one bit. It doesn't bother me at all. The law of identity, roughly, says that something possesses one set of properties. It doesn't possess the opposite set of properties in the same way, in the same respect. So if you want to say that the mind is identical to the brain, all the list of qualities for the mind has to be exactly the same as all the list of qualities for the brain. That's just the principle of identity. Now, the essential problem and why the materialists are so bothered and consternated is that consciousness does not neatly fit into any physical description. Even if you can correlate it with physical events in the brain, that's not the same as identifying it as physical events in the brain. Now, back to the comment that was raised earlier about thinking of the pink elephant. If you imagine a pink elephant, you are having an experience, an imaginative experience. It's called qualia, or just being there. You are experiencing it in the first person. Now, someone could exhaustively dissect and analyze and photograph your brain when you're thinking of a pink elephant and never see a pink elephant. You can't get from the third person to the first person. If you see someone else in terrible pain, you may sympathize with them and try to help them, but you literally cannot feel their pain, even if you are an absolute expert on the pain system of the human body, and you know more about how pain works physiologically than the person in pain. They're in pain and you're not. You can't bring the third person into the first person. This is a metaphysical barrier. Science will never solve it. because it's a metaphysical barrier. It has to do with the very nature of consciousness. Yes?
Same thing applies to the studies they've done on identical twins. How one twin knows, has a sense of what's going on with the other twin.
Well, that would be a different kind of argument. I mean, you might want to argue that there is some immaterial connection with respect to knowledge between certain persons. And the best explanation would be something immaterial. Now, I think some of that could be explained on the level of intuition or the level of similarity. But it could be there are cases where the physical resources really don't do enough explaining to account for it. Yes? It still does nothing philosophically, because correlation is not identity. The C firings in your mind are not the same as the feeling of pain. They're not the same things, given the law of identity. It's impossible. Now, what happens is you get basically a promissory note. Oh, somehow we'll be able to translate these third-person reports exhaustively, so we won't need this subjectivity anymore, this consciousness. We'll be able to, in a sense, eliminate the consciousness by a thorough physical description. I'll give you a thorough physical description. You'll never be able to duplicate the felt nature of consciousness. Now, I've only talked about qualia. There are other states that we'll talk about next time, like intentionality or propositional attitudes. If I'm thinking about my 76 Gremlin and where is it today and what did the guy do with it and did he really fix it up and is he treating it properly? We were quite attached to that car, actually. I have a state of mind which is about a 76 Gremlin that my wife and I used to own. It's about that. How in the world do you possibly describe physically aboutness or ofness, such that it captures that relationship? Or how do you capture the propositional attitude of I believe X, or I don't believe X, or I'm agnostic about X, or I don't understand what X means? Those are first-person intentional states. Intentional states are states that have a reference outside of the self. That's what intentional means. There doesn't even have to be an object. You could worry about werewolves. You could worry about Dracula, and that's an intentional state, even though there's no correlating object. It's a state of mind. And that state of mind could be correlated with firings in the brain, but correlation is not identity. That's one of the basic arguments. Okay? So anytime you read something like Steven Pinker or others that cite all this physical evidence that we've reduced the brain to the mind, just bring up the principle of identity in first-person reference. And they should cringe if they're thinking hard about it. Because the more thoughtful people, like Colin McGinn and others, say, we have a terrible problem with consciousness as materialists. You know, it's tough. In fact, McGinn basically gives up the mysterious flame. It will always be a mystery because evolution wired us to not understand consciousness. All right, questions or comments? I want to come back briefly to this argument. It's a tough argument to understand, but it's actually quite a powerful one, because this is very real to people, their own consciousness. They're quite close to their own consciousness. And if you say, look, just leave the rest of the universe aside for a minute, all these cosmic constants that have to be there for you to exist at all, let's look at the nature of your consciousness. Is it explicable on the basis of merely material factors? If not, what is a better explanation for why you can think at all? All right, any closing comments, questions? I know we're over time, but quickly, yes.
Could you use certain developments in psychology as examples of how consciousness might be related to physical evolution?
Well, yeah, behaviorism's been pretty decisively refuted. That kind of materialism, I think, is sunk, certainly. There's some research now on what's called the neuroplasticity of the brain, that consciousness actually changes brain states. It's not the other way around. There's been some writing on that. It makes perfectly good sense. In fact, I might get to it next time. There was a scientist by the name of Penfield years ago who did experiments on patients who suffered from epilepsy. And he actually discovered that there was a consciousness distinct from the brain, that he could activate certain parts of the brain and people would feel things. But there was still a level of consciousness that he could not control by his activating prods and so on. He wrote a book called The Mystery of the Mind to account for that. So you might say that indirectly there's even some scientific evidence that while the mind is correlated to the brain and mental states are correlated to physical states, that the mind uses the brain and is not reducible to the brain, but is also in many ways dependent upon the brain. We wouldn't deny that at all. And one of the objections is, well, how can something so different, an immaterial substance, relate to a material substance? People said that's impossible. They're too different to interact. There's actually a response to that as well. So I'll come back to those things next time. All right. Have a good week, and then we'll find out who won this debate.